Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his ex-soldier turned mob boss friend, Duncan Nicol.
Duncan, it's good to be back in the world of just sort of grungy urban fantasy.
It is very nice, particularly for me. This is a slice of the fantasy pie that I have a certain extra liking to. I think, I don't know what it is, something about it means that maybe something that would normally go down as like a 5, if it's in this sort of ballpark, it's kicked up to a 7 for me.
Right, because this week we're doing The Straight Razor Cure by Daniel Polansky, also called Lowtown, the first book in the Lowtown trilogy.
That's right. Now, bit of background, I have previously read the entire trilogy.
Oh,
I am
okay.
A veteran of this. I really like Daniel Polansky as an author. He has a duology, a similar kind of grungy dark fantasy duology out. He's also written a couple of apparently very interesting short stories. He's even written the only other short story or section of a story written in the second person that I think is halfway sort of decent.
Interesting.
The first one obviously being of the fifth season, which is the best use of it I've ever had.
Yes, that's definitely the, when I turn to a book and I look to the second person, that's the one I look to. The only other example of a really successful second person narrative is A Story About You, which is just a given episode of Welcome to Night Vale that I just think is really good.
So Geordie, before we dive into The Straight Razor Cure, have you read anything else in the intervening time?
No, I've been very busy still. I was so busy and so tired that I actually uploaded our episode of Witcher with 5 minutes of dead air at the start. So I am barely keeping it together.
Wow. Don't worry, mate. Happens to the very best of us. But I hope that correction's down. And please, everyone, thank you for joining us at the start of 2025. Ooh, hitting the ground running. I've also been very busy as well. I have only read Straight Razor Cure, and to be brutally honest, it was a read that I started off, I'll just flick through the top of it, and then I suddenly realised, oh no, wait, no, I need to stop and reread in detail.
Right, because it is a mystery novel, the detail matters.
It does. So, let's kind of get the vague premise out. The Straight Razor Cure is it's a murder mystery. I would almost say it has elements of noir kicking about. Not that, yes, I truly know what that term means.
Absolutely. It's very much a noir, and it's more so just a noir as opposed to it being a murder mystery, because you have noir stories like, say, Double Indemnity, which are definitively noir, but they're not about a murder mystery. Like, the main character is the one who does the murder. No. And the reason I make the distinction is that this isn't like a Poirot story, you know? It's not solely about, oh, something has happened, and the detective needs to figure out what that is.
No, I think a very even amount of time is spent in this novel with our main character, Warden, who fulfills the role of the detective, but he spends just as much time, I feel like, negotiating sort of the underworld and the political mechanisms, and a lot of times just kind of given over to sort of the fleshing out of the world that Warden inhabits.
Yes, I agree. That's definitely the case. And I think it is something that does work about the story. I do have a real sense of Lowtown as a living, breathing space. I have a good sense of the different issues that people have. You know, I get a sense of where the different sources of friction within the narrative, like, it's very explicit in the way that, like, there's a lot of racial division in the city that comes down, and you have, like, you know, the city's divided up into, like, various ghettos.
And it kind of lent into my original point of having to, like, oh no, I need to sit down and reread this in detail. Because although I could basically recount to you the core sort of murder mystery, you know, I know, yeah, that person gets killed there, and that's how he finds that out, and then, you know, I remember who done it. There are so many, I don't want to say vignettes, like, they're sort of pointless, but they are, they're sort of these little world building episodes that are really enjoyable. And when you first read it through and you're like, oh, how do these fit in? I think maybe you have a bit more of that, but maybe they don't necessarily go anywhere. There's quite a lot of characters in this book that I feel kind of come and go as Warden sort of interacts with them just to sort of expand that bit of Lowtown's world.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. It's something that, like, it could be a serious detriment to the book. Like, if I was in a very negative frame of mind, I could say a lot of the story is spent wasted on stuff that isn't about the main mystery. But the fact of the matter is that, for the most part, that slight, you know, looking to the side, that sort of thing, it tends to work out, more or less. Does it slow the story down? Yes, absolutely it does. I'd say it has a knock-on effect that does diminish the quality of the book. But the stuff there, you know, it is of a certain quality that I can't dismiss it. It does get into, like, you can tell that Daniel Polansky is trying with every bone in his body not to be racist about Chinese people. But he flirts with it in a way that, like, I just don't think he was really capable of writing, you know?
Yes, I do know. I think this comes down to an author who, I'm inclined to say, has no real ill intent, but wants to write a world that is racist and has racist characters.
Yeah.
And it definitely gets muddied at times, where what is Warden's perspective and what is the author laying out.
Exactly.
And like I said, I think it does speak more to maybe just a slight lack of finesse rather than an ill intent.
I definitely am on the same page as you, Duncan, because a lot of the stuff you're seeing is just like, yeah, this is Warden, and I can tell from his perspective that, like, we're not supposed to agree with this. We can see this is coming from a place of ignorance. But, you know, in the character of, I think he's called Li Shan, you know, in him, we see this caricature, a so explicitly old-fashioned racist caricature of a Chinese person, even down to having, like, a Fu Manchu, that it really defies belief that you're seeing it on the page. You're like, why? Like, genuinely, why? You know, we're 20 years separated from Deadwood, which was a series that where every single character was racist towards Chinese people, but the story itself really isn't that racist towards them.
I'm not really sure what more to add on to this point. It's sort of, I'm saying, I do think it's a point that I think Daniel Polansky does improve in subsequent stories. Although I'm not going to lie, there's a bit in the third one where, I'm just going to put that out, we get sort of this redneck hillbilly archetype.
Right.
And it gave me a very similar reaction. I went, anyway, where are we going?
Yeah, that is a slightly less important thing. I'm surprised I even brought it up this early in the episode, because really what we should be doing is we should be giving an initial reaction to how did we find the novel.
Yes, absolutely. That is not far more important, but how we should structure this. Our way. So, Geordie, I brought this novel to you because I would stand by and say I like this book.
Sure.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the whole trilogy. I will not stand here and say it is one of the absolute greatest. This is not Kings of the Wild. But it gave me enough of a unique flavour that it's really stuck with me. And I enjoy it for that.
Yeah. And you were nervous about bringing it to the table, as you said in our previous episode, because I had such a negative reaction to The Gutter's Prayer. Why are those stories being mentioned in the same breath?
So, I think because if you try to describe them in terms of genre, there's a lot of crossover. They are both urban fantasies dealing with sort of criminal underworlds and moving mechanisms of the characters, with a degree of underlying mystery. Unlike The Gutter's Prayer, which I'm just going to say, not as well written. Sorry, actually, no, like The Gutter's Prayer, which I was going to say, not as well written. It does put a lot of time and energy into the world building.
Mm.
What I think The Straight Razor Cure does really well, or a lot better than The Gutter's Prayer, is Straight Razor Cure has a much more focused narrative. And
yeah,
I think
definitely.
Its core cast of characters are just a hell of a lot more deep and interesting. That's my take. Geordie, do you agree with my assessment?
I definitely agree that this book is better than The Gutter's Prayer.
Nice.
I don't think it's a good book.
Oh!
I call it a 5 out of 10. I'm not going to say it's a bad book, but it's not good.
I refer back to my opening comments on, it's just that flavour that takes a 5 out of 10 up to a 7 out of 10 for me.
Yeah, I was thinking when you said that, I'd be like, oh, well, watch out for that, pal. Yeah, you know, like, the balance between world building and the actual mystery does take it up from a 3.5 to a 5. Duncan, this book's fucking cringe.
Oh my god.
I don't think I've ever used that word in the entirety of the podcast, but it's really, it's just true. I just don't like the writing style at all. I just really can't stand it.
I certainly think there's a bit of this book where I wonder, is the author doing like, because when you talk about earlier, I use the word like, oh, it's a bit like noir. And I'm not going to say I have great experience in that genre, but there are bits in this book where I'm like, are you paying homage to something? Are you attempting to really strongly walk like the beaten archetype? Which I can definitely see that angle. And also, this book obviously is focusing with elements of sort of the grimdark. And there are, I definitely think there are moments which it kind of tries to be edgy in a way that makes it does look slightly, 14-year-old boy trying to be edgy.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. How old was he when he wrote this book?
That is not a question I can answer right now. One second. So Daniel Polansky would have been, so he's 41 now. This book was released in 2011, so 14 years ago. So that would have made him in his late 20s?
I guess that checks out. I think if you're of a certain disposition, maybe this could seem really cool. The fact that it's written by a man in his 20s instead of his 30s, I think does sort of check out.
Okay, Jordy. So you're calling it cringe. Can you, and do you go with the points that I would identify why someone would think of it cringe? That's very much where you're coming from?
Yeah, it's all about the fact that it is trying to be dark and brooding and edgy, and it's trying to do the noir thing. And when I say the noir thing, what I really mean is it's trying to be Raymond Chandler. Duncan, you probably know who Raymond Chandler is. Have you ever read his stuff?
I actually haven't, and I do really think I should, because I feel like I would like it.
You definitely would, Duncan, because, you know, you're someone who enjoys pulpy fiction, and Raymond Chandler is a guy who, you know, he was writing novels. Like, he wasn't, you know, just writing, actually, you know, I tell a lie, I don't know whether he was writing, like, for magazines and stuff as well. Given the era he was writing, he probably was, but he's best known for novels like The Big Sleep. But I'm going to read to you a quote from Farewell, My Lovely, one of his famous Philip Marlowe stories. This is the iconic detective. And let me see if you can sort of recognize the influence he's had on Daniel Polansky. I needed a drink. I needed a lot of life insurance. I needed a vacation. I needed a home in the country. What I had was a coat, a hat, and a gun. I put them on and went out of room. All right, so you can hear it, right? You can hear what he's going for.
Yes, definitely. And from my perspective, I think it's delivered in a sufficiently enjoyable way. So we're talking about Daniel Polansky. We're talking about...
I figured we were talking about Daniel Polansky here. So, you know, the point I'm making is that he's going for that same dark, jaded detective. You know, this detective is also a down on his luck guy living in a fetid city. You know, he has like problems with substances. Philip Marlowe is an alcoholic, just like Raymond Chandler. And, you know, he has this sardonic, dark, moody perspective. The difference is that it's like charm. You got it or you don't. And Warden is not as charming as Philip Marlowe. He seems like a character who's completely assured of his own intelligence, and it makes him seem quite smarmy in every scene.
I would somewhat agree. Warden definitely has a cockiness to him. You know, he thinks because he, due to his sort of background and his training, he's one step ahead of basically all the kind of criminals that he interacts with. Now, you say kind of smarmy. I think he gives him a slightly cocky edge, but also I think from a reading perspective, because you kind of see that, it sort of means that when he does sort of blunder, you kind of chalk it down to that. It's like, oh, you've been too cocky. You know, you as a reader can look at him and be like, should have been better.
I mean, that's true. I mean, it does work in that, you know, he is so assured of his intelligence. I mean, for one thing, it's all from his perspective. It's a first person present tense story. So, you know, like, you're always in his head. You're always seeing things the way he is. But the fact of the matter is the fact that, you know, Polanski is trying to make him seem cool and down to earth, I don't really accept that it's just, like, all through his filter. I think we are supposed to come away with a strongly positive impression of him. And I can tell you some more reasons why this is the case. Because just like someone like Philip Marlowe, this is someone who's down on his luck. He used to be a real copper. You know, he used to be a lawman, and then he got kicked out of the force for nebulous reasons that aren't explained in this book. We understand that it had something to do with a woman. We understand that it had something to do with drug use. And now he's a man of the street. He's a drug dealer. You know, he's a violent thug in the language of the book. But the difference there is that Polanski isn't actually interested in having an especially morally complex protagonist, because you never actually see him deal drugs to normal people. You know, if you really wanted to make this dark and kind of shocking, you would have him pushing drugs on vulnerable people, vulnerable poor people who live in his community. The only people we see him sell drugs to are the extremely rich. And more than that, they're like textually the bad guys in the story.
Yes, I would agree. There's definitely an element, and sorry, no, I'm doing that thing again. I'm referencing Robert E. Howard's Conan, where we get told that he does all these bad things and they always happen off page. And all the time, it's that classic setup of, well, he's got some rough edges, but you know, deep down, he's had a heart of gold and he's looking out for his community. And that would work better if he actually had some more defined rough edges. Like, he barely starts, you know, he doesn't attack anyone that doesn't really attack him first. He doesn't do anything unless he thinks it's in the better interest of, you know, solving the case, finding the murderer. And you're right, it's very, very clear that he's sending drugs to the pompous elites. He's, you know, invited to their parties. It's on their terms. They're so high and mighty. It's almost irrelevant what they're doing.
Yeah, like, take characters like Tony Soprano and Walter White. We actually see that, like, it's some of the most vulnerable people in society who are caught up in the drug trade. You know, we feel sympathy for the characters who this is inflicted upon. We never go, like, you know, like, oh, well, it doesn't matter if you're getting a bad, you know, a bad batch. It doesn't matter what's going to happen next. Because of yada, yada, yada. And it's not even, like, forget it. You know, I've said enough on this point. Like, here's the real reason, right? The real reason that you have him being a drug user and a drug pusher is that it's combining characters like Walter White with Sherlock Holmes.
Okay, I can see that. So what's your... Is there a critique in there?
Only in that Sherlock Holmes is a really great character, and it just kind of irritated me to see him compared to Warden.
I think where Warden, though, does work quite well is the fact that quite a lot of time, you know, when bad things happen or, you know, at the end of this bad day, you see him either kind of take his own supply. There's moments where he gets completely drunk. He acts out to his, like, best friend, Adolphus. And I think there's an element where you're meant to look at him and actually find him quite pitiful.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is somewhat something that works. I remember once listening to a couple of people reviewing the first season of Jessica Jones. And I remember one of them saying that, like, you know, in this character, you have, like, the classic alcoholic detective. You know, an absolute trope at this point. And what they took umbrage with in it is that one of the people said, you know, my ex-partner was an alcoholic. And what you need to understand about alcoholics is that they're the most toxic people on the planet. and just being in proximity to them is like being in a proximity to poison. And so the way in which they demonstrated a character like that without actually like inspecting what it would mean to the characters around them who are in their proximity and who care about them, I'd say at least in this case, yes, Daniel Polanski is doing a better job of showing that the destructive habits of Warden are having an impact on the people around him in his personal life. Adolphus, you know, at one point, like, he just has to give Adolphus, like, really hard truth and tell him, like, you're not coming on this mission with me because you're too fat and you're too old and you were never that good in the first place. And it's a really brutal line. And you're like, yeah, this is an effective scene. I'm having to see the main character be an asshole to his best friend in order to keep him safe. That's an effective scene. The fact that, like, you know, he can't keep Ren out of danger, and the fact that, like, his method for trying to teach Ren and get him to grow up doesn't work, and we see it not work on the page, that's effective stuff. I agree.
Just to do a quick flyby, so Adolphus is Warden's best friend, arguably only friend, the old ex-soldier buddies, and Adolphus, when he came back from the war, opened up a tavern, and it's from this tavern that our character Warden basically operates out of. Ren is a street urchin who picks up in the early parts of the story, who kind of hangs around, and then Warden begrudgingly is like, well, I'm going to try and guide you in my best broken way. I really like...
Yeah, and...
Sorry, just to talk about things I really like, because... Yeah, you friend a lot of her. Now let me kind of fling back some things I really like. Because one of the things I said that I really like, obviously, the world building here I think is done a lot better than something like The Ghost of Prayer, but I actually really like a lot of these characters. So we talked about Warden, and you said, you know, you're meant to find him cool. I debate that slightly. I think you're actually meant to find him a little bit more pitiful and pick up on the sense of his own inflated ego. Because I don't think there are that many moments where he actually throws down a line and everyone's meant to applaud. Like, he actually gets roughed up.
I disagree, and I can prove it.
I said that many moments. I didn't say any moments.
You go ahead, but I'll come back.
And I also liked some of the other characters. The character of Adolphus. I really like the fact that in their relationship, both of them throw down hard truths. You know, you can tell that they have this deep friendship from what they've been through, but they're not quite on the same page anymore. But because of their history, neither of them is going to up and dump the other. So I really thought that was a nice take. I actually wish Adolphus maybe did go on a little bit more of the adventure with him. I know the key point is that Warden tells him he can't, because I really like the interaction, but I do like it how at the end of the day, every kind of day of investigation, Warden comes back to the tavern and Adolphus is just like, what happened to you? And this is when we get those sort of pitiful moments where Warden, you know, doesn't get to maybe open up to his friend and have that sort of healthy communication like we'd ever expect it. He either gets completely drunk or goes and takes his own supply or just lies down in his bed. So that was really nice. I also liked it when they just...
Yes, Duncan. Yes, that's all true. But what you're missing there is the suffering in silence and going about your business and not talking to your friend is part of the same power fantasy as being the guy in a room who's smarter than everyone else.
I think, now this is where, maybe, and this isn't 100% true because I did enjoy this book more before I finished the whole trilogy. Later on in the series, I think Daniel Polanski does deliver a very strong message about how this is not the right way to go about things. But I was actually surprised reading this first book. It's not here. I want to make that clear.
Yeah, okay, that's fine, but we don't need there to be I said again, Sunset Boulevard, like, oh, one of the message kids, you know, telling a story isn't enough, huh? You know, I don't need the book to morally grandstand and tell me what's right and wrong. All I tend to point out is that the book doesn't work for me because the whole book is smarmy. The whole book is channeling behind the, you know, you're following the guy who thinks he's smarter than everyone else and who you're supposed to think is cool. And the reason I know people are supposed to think this is cool, and people do think this is cool because people like this book, is because I read this book on Kindle. I couldn't get an audiobook version this time, so I read it on Kindle. And when you read something on Kindle, you can see the places that other people have underlined, the bits that people have highlighted. So, I'm going to read a section. I hadn't tooled up before going to visit Mary. seemed like a bad way to make an impression. But I wouldn't need a weapon to get the jump on this skinny little bastard. The only thing better than ambushing a motherfucker is ambushing the motherfucker who thinks he's ambushing you.
Okay, right, there's a small amount of cringe in that, I'll admit. I think my counterpoint that I'm trying to say and why this didn't come off as bad to me is that because he goes out with the smiling attitude, but inevitably rocks up at the end of the day a bit more broken, I think it strikes a balance. Whether or not the majority of people see it or not, that was my takeaway.
But it's not a question to me of like getting his comeuppance. The point is that I have to spend all my time with this guy acting like he's so smart. And what it comes down to as well is the actual way the book is written. Now, that doesn't come across in the passage I've just read, because what we're looking at there is straightforward, down-to-earth stuff. But occasionally, and I don't even mean occasionally, on a very frequent basis, you really get the sense that Daniel Polanski just loves big words, and big words employed for no real effect. There's a scene there. You want to talk about one of those scenes where, like, he's casually using drugs to get through the day. There's a bit, he starts a chapter by saying, you know, this isn't an exact quote, but one of his words is, I woke up feeling groggy from, like, the pipe I had immolated.
What? You don't tell me how, you don't get to work and say how you immolated your breakfast?
Not even that, because what he's saying is he'd burnt. Like, immolate means, you know, obviously it means to burn something. But you don't say, oh, I immolated a pack of cigarettes. That's insane. No one would ever talk like that. Like, to me, immolate is like completely destroy down to the finest ash, you know? Just say smoked. Like, it's not impressive to use big words like this.
Oh, I love this discussing your backup so much. And here I stand, yeah, I'm like...
I mean, I don't like inkhorns at the best of time.
Okay. You've got your points, your stance. I will stand by that I somewhat disagree with your interpretation of... Or at least I had a different experience with the character of Warden, which probably might even be unique to most people. I will say, if you are one of those people that would find the character who is very cocksure fun to read about, this book's got you, mate. Don't you worry. 15-year-olds, it's here. Let's then move on. Can we actually talk a bit more about Ren? Ren is a character. What do you think about him?
Ren's fine. There's not really a lot to him. He's sort of a plucky, artful dodger character. I like his interactions with the main character. I like seeing Warden sort of mold him into a new version of himself and it not working. I like him okay. I get the impression from your question that Ren is very important for sequels.
Well, the problem is, what's actually I find difficult in your answer, is that I basically would have said everything you've just said. I was going to call him plucky, I was going to call him the Artful Dodger character. I was going to say I was really interested about how Warden tries to mould him, except I was just going to say it all with far more enthusiasm. It's so funny the same book, and we've got almost the same points. We just liked it differently. This is very hard to discuss.
Yeah, I mean, that's the difference, right? Is that you read this book and you said it's an 8 out of 10, and I read this book and I observed in the same way you did, and I said it was a 5 out of 10.
Oh, gosh. It's like when I think Miss Vaughn. Is it Miss Vaughn? I'm going to go, yeah, I think it's the Miss Vaughn, where like just Brandon Sanderson in general, often his detractors and the many people who have positives, like they bring up the same points.
Yes.
It's just some like them, some don't.
Yeah, exactly. No, his writing's very really direct. With me.
Oh, I like that. I do not. There's not a lot you can kind of shake down the middle. I like seeing this plucky character, and I really do enjoy Warden's attempt to, you know, I like the fact that Warden, to a certain extent, you know, thinks he's doing the right thing. He's like, I'm getting this kid ready to face the harsh world. And it kind of goes wrong in so many ways. One, it's sort of the... Are you kind of just doing a bit of self-corruption? And two, you expect that this kid isn't you. He's not a younger you, Warden. And he has his own feelings, vibes, and wants. Why do you think it goes so wrong, actually, from your perspective?
Duncan, before I answer that question, I was just scrolling through my Kindle trying to find an example of overly flowery language that I was complaining about. And I accidentally found a line which I underscored because I felt it was deeply ironic, where... where he comes back in and Adolphus says, I'm sorry, he said, simply. The fact that he honestly meant it worth more than any attempt at eloquence. look in a mirror, Polanski, come on.
I think that's fine. If anything, because it's from Warden's perspective, I can't believe I made this argument, because it's from Warden's perspective, does that not just sort of hint at the fact that Warden has a deeper intellectual side that he doesn't let out in any other
way?
What
are you talking about? The Warden doesn't let out his intellectual side. He spends the whole thing waffling in high flowery language. And like, there's bits in it that, like, okay, I'm getting a bit flustered and upset now, but there is a bit which I find frustrating, is that, yes, Daniel Polanski has him be this rough man of the streets, you know, like a orphan of this disease that swept through the city, but he also has him be the protege of, like, the high wizard who looks after the city and, like, has tutored him through his adolescence. So on one hand, he is both this rough guy of the streets, but he's also this very adroit, well-educated young man. I don't have an issue with that per se. It's just that I feel like there's a strong friction that exists here. And frankly, it almost comes across as like a sort of classism, because obviously it's about a detective, and detectives are supposed to be clever characters. That's what's so enjoyable about seeing them put together clues. I find it frustrating the fact that he feels like he has to make him this adroit character who's well-read, who reads, like, at one point, at later part of the book, a history book before he goes to bed. You know, like he's Sherlock Holmes, he has a bookcase full of reference materials. But he doesn't want him to just speak in plain language, or just be a guy who's from down the street, you know? Just a clever working man. He has to be adroit, and he has to be a scholar, and raised by this wise wizard.
That's definitely a bit of a backstory that always kind of jarred with me. Because we basically learned that Warden has been a street urchin, a wizard's apprentice, a war vet, and almost basically a war hero at one point. Mm-hmm. Also, he was a lead detective in the secret police organization. And you are just a bit like,
oh, don't forget Duncan, when he was put into, like, the secret CIA as well, because he was, like, in port charge of special operations.
I've basically always thought when reading this book, so we learn a lot about, I believe it's called Black House, which is the secret operations. You know, these are the people pulling the strings behind not only society, but basically the government as well.
Yeah.
And I just don't buy it. So Warden, we learn, is in an incident, which is less ambiguous in this book, is disgraced and it's kicked out. And there's just a bit of me that's like, I get the vibe this is the organisation that probably would have just killed him.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not even talking about the CIA. We're talking about, like, the SMBP. This is a secret police.
You don't let that guy retire and then take up residence in, like, and, like, take a section of the criminal underworld.
I'm shaking my head. It is just a bit silly. Like, just don't have him be a secret agent. Just stop one step before that, you know?
I think it would have worked very well if he was just a normal detective. And then it could just play into, like, the realization of the corrupt society that he's operating in. Because that's a key point of the story, is the fact that he is trying to represent the people of Lowtown, because, you know, the greater mechanisms aren't going to deal with these murders. So he's got to step in.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, a big theme of the story is that, this is a sort of vigilante detective who has to step up because the police aren't going to do anything.
Do you know what? I was about to segue into the murder itself, but almost now I'm like, oh, I could segue into the world building, the greater plot. I think we're going to hit the murder itself. Geordie,
yeah.
This is a murder mystery. What did you think of it as a murder mystery? Come on, put that one down. Did you like the turns, the steps of the investigation, and the ultimate reveal? Like, because I personally thought that this murder mystery was very enjoyable, because although it wasn't something where I could necessarily piece it all together from I see this, you know, these elements laid, you know, the breadcrumbs laid for me in the plot by Daniel Polanski, and there was definitely an element of, I'm going to make a guess based on the type of story Daniel Polanski is very clearly telling. I did enjoy going through the motions of this murder mystery. I enjoyed seeing one body show up, we meet some people, we have a conversation, which I genuinely enjoyed a lot of those sort of interview stage bits, and then another body shows up and it evolves and it and tension builds and builds and builds.
I don't know. I'm in two minds. On one hand, I kind of like a bunch of the twists and turns. The resolution wasn't what I expected. I made a mental note that, because I was reading on Kindle, I could see my exact progress for the book. So at 52%, I made a mental note of exactly what I thought the ending of the book was going to be. And I got like 1.5 things wrong and everything else right. But unfortunately, those 1.5 things were actually quite big. So, yeah, I'd say I definitively got it wrong. So, to lay it out quite plainly, the mystery is children are going missing. They turn up murdered. And then, and it seems like at first it's a common, you know, child molester who's doing this. But ultimately, the twist adds up. One thing, actually, I'll say, jumping right here, something I really like about this book, and I think it does really effectively, is dropping in the different fantasy elements one by one. When you first start this book, there's absolutely no indication that it's a fantasy story at all. And then, like, one little thing gets dropped in. Oh, and then, and just one more thing. And then one more thing. And it drips you through until, like, halfway through the book, until you have the full, the absolute full picture of all the different magical stuff. For example, when he catches the child molester and he's about to pin him down and beat him up and take him in, a demon shows up. And demons have never been mentioned in this book up till now. You know, we know there are wizards by this point, not demons. So when it does show up, it is shocking and it like widens the scope and it does create this really effective moment of, oh man, how deep does this go? So kudos there. That was a really good trick.
A positive note. Excellent.
I've said lots of positive things about this book. We just happen to have spoken about all the crap stuff for a while.
No, and I really like that because I also like the fact that the world building, it doesn't feel like we're pausing too often. It's not like we're taking long pauses, let me check correct myself. We do pause for world building, but not taking long pauses. As the murder mystery evolves, we're slowly seeing more and more of this world. And as Warden goes on his investigation to new places, we then learn more about those areas, particularly all contained in this city. Which, by the way, I really enjoy. The fact that... No, so I'm going off. Stay on the murder mystery, Duncan.
So, yeah, excellent. We'll come back to that.
I mean, guys, you like that element, and I thought, I like the fact that because of, you know, a lot of these characters who are getting murdered, they're not ones that we have a big emotional connection to. That's, you know, it's not something that we meet beforehand and we grow a relation with and then they die. But the fact that we're kind of generally, we're seeing the people who are being impacted and we're getting a sense of this community as a whole, I still felt incredibly driven to be like, okay, let's find out. Let's stop this before someone we actually do care about gets hurt.
Yeah, because once you've introduced the fact that like he has a young protege, it's like pretty obvious where that aspect of the story is going. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes seeing a twist coming way in the future is actually a good thing. Sometimes that creates tension, and I think that works effectively here with Ren. You've got a character you kind of like. You see that he's the one who's going to be in danger. Later on, he is in danger. That's good writing. Good job.
I would also say, on that point, Jordy, tell me if you disagree, but due to the general tone of this story, I genuinely wasn't confident if Daniel Polansky was going to kill off Ren or let him be saved. Like,
no,
I personally, there's enough ambiguity, I thought it could go either way.
No, disagree. The only difference is that I thought, this is literally the only difference that I... Okay, I'll lay it out now. Spoilers ahead. There are two things I got wrong about the climax. I predicted most of it straight down the line and said, okay, yes. The big thing I got wrong was that I thought that the person doing the murders, or at least the first murder, was Blue Ren, was his mentor. The reason I thought this is I thought the big twist was going to be that the wards that had shown up in order to stop the plague in the first place had been accomplished through the exact same means. It was demon magic used by human sacrificing children. And therefore, as the wards were failing, now that he was dying, it had to be repeated again. So the first child that goes is Blue Wren demonstrating how to do this to a cabal of wizards, which could or might not include Celia. And the reason why I felt there was a really strong indication this would be the case was that there was a big note in the story that the children were abducted without force. And what we learn is that Wren is really good with kids. So it made sense to me that Blue Wren would be able to lure kids away by using like his special magic flute, which entertains children. And it would be extra grim and dark if he, the guy who raised like two children, turned out to be a child murderer. And the reason why he's so upset when he finds out that a second murder has happened is that he's like, oh no, it's still happening. It didn't work just once. And now these wizards I've trained how to recreate the wards are still doing it.
I mean, that is actually a really good theory, Jordy, and would definitely deliver a very different emotional sucker punch if that had been how it had turned out. Just a little backstory to people who maybe haven't read the book on what Joyce just described. So pre the start of the story, when our main character Warden is a child, there is a plague that ravages the city, and everyone praises Blue Wren, also known as the Crane, who is a great magician who basically
Blue Crane, not Wren. That's my bad. I'm sorry.
Asking like, did you? Was that mentioned? I knew him as the Crane throughout. The wizard who put up the wards, the Crane, and he saved the day. And then he eventually adopts the orphans of the plague, one being our main character, Warden. He jumping
forward in
time.
And the other being Celia, a girl who Warden finds in the ruins of a city and takes to Crane to raise, and she becomes his apprentice.
Yes, it is worth noting that Warden doesn't really have any of that kind of background magical training, whereas Celia does. So Warden ultimately leaves and pursues his own life of soldiering and CIA-ing and ultimately a drug dealer mob bossering. That's all young kids do.
Yeah.
So that's a good theory. Ultimately, what we get instead is that Celia is the one who's doing it. This was not the method it was done before, but in sort of a panic that the wards are failing, she's attempting to do any level of magic, a sort of experimentation to find a way to stop the plague returning.
Yeah, so the difference there is that, and this is the big twist, which surprised me, is that Crane found an actual perfect means, but other people cannot replicate it. And so, Omalas style, the plague can only be kept at bay now through continuous child sacrifice, which is very grim. I felt like there was going to be a big twist at the end, being like, no, we only need one more child if we just kill Wren. Nope. Yes, Wren, not Crane this time, I do mean Wren. Then we'll be able to keep off the plague forever. And the big challenge at the end would be Warden saying,
what, The Last of Us?
The Last of Us, yes.
Again.
Would be him saying, no, I'm not going to let you sacrifice this child because it's wrong. I mean, he'd take it back. And then he'd be responsible for everything that comes after. But actually, no. There's no indication that he'd ever stop killing children. So there really isn't that much. I guess it's still a quandary. But it would mean that everyone would just have to be really cool about child murder. And I don't think there's any real scenario where you'll expect any protagonist to be like, yep, let it slide. Keep it going, Celia.
No, I think there's a low level moral quandary in the sense that, you know, how many people died to the plague. Celia's working in a very mathematical weighing up there. But there's no quandary for our main character, Warden, really. He would have to abandon his whole campaign and just be like, yeah, sure thing.
Yep, I didn't see anything. I would just go back to whatever. So, the murder mystery is okay. I like it enough. You can see where it's coming from a long way off, but again, I say that having got some really important issues wrong, because the other thing which I got wrong was I thought that I knew that the blade, or
Beaconfield.
I knew that he was, like, not the main bad guy, and that was something he needed to figure out. But I was still trying to figure out, but how is he connected? He must be connected somehow, but it's not obvious why. And the big twist is, he's not connected at all. It's literally a red herring that he's been deliberately tricked into believing, which is, on one hand, it is a good twist because it tricked me. I didn't see that coming. On the other hand, it's like, oh, well, that kind of makes it all into a bit of a waste of time, doesn't it?
I would say not, just because I do enjoy the fact that firstly, he gives a sort of a physical challenge to Warden. And the fact that he's sort of going down this path, you know, we do it is an excuse to explore many other aspects of the world.
Yeah, but those aspects of the world aren't important if that guy isn't in the story, you know?
Well,
you know, the upper echelons and the nobles, they aren't important to the story if that character isn't in it. It's not like if Fair Beacon wasn't in the story and we didn't have those scenes at his parties, I'd be like, well, hang on, what are the nobles up to? I wouldn't care. And so I'm going to say one more thing, which is that, you know, this book really reeks of being written by an American when it's talking about the upper crust. You know what I mean?
Oh, I do know what you mean. No, I don't know. What? How do the Americans differ?
Well, it's just a way in which, so like, I've seen hundreds of British writers complain about the aristocracy in a way that is of a lived experience, because the main difference is it's more than just
wealth.
You know, that's the fundamental thing. When it comes down to, if you're a British person, the main resentment you'll have against the upper classes is that they have a lot of money, which probably shouldn't all belong to them.
Well, it also speaks to the several other aspects as well, I would find, because often you get the element of, it's not just about wealth. You can't just be rich enough and be the same as your traditional aristocracy. There's an other element.
And it's the other thing, which is that things like the sense of tradition and of innate more importance, of greater worthiness, is felt much more from a British perspective. You mean, like these are people who genuinely somehow believe they're bulletproof. You know, they believe there's something special about them that sets them apart from common people. But that's not the way Daniel Polansky writes about them. The way Daniel Polansky writes about them is the way I hear aristocracy spoken about by Americans all the time, which is that they just focus on the inbreeding.
Which is not unique to them.
We're not defending inbreeding. It's just that this is something which I hear Americans talk about all the time, especially in the context of when they talk about, say, European history. They really play up the idea of aristocrats or kings and queens marrying their cousins and stuff, which is definitely true. That did happen, like a bunch. But it's not the all-encompassing thing you guys think it is, you know?
It's part of the sort of the larger context of keeping, like, the wealth in the family and within certain circles. Like, that was part of the hoarding the wealth element. But I think the key point I would say, sorry, if you're someone from across the pond listening to this, I think some of the more key points is what Georgie said, that kind of self-importance. Because obviously, particularly in Britain, the royal family is closely related to the church and actual divinity, mm-hmm, by our national rules.
And the literal kind of divine right of kings.
Yes. That took us down to the rest of the aristocracy, and also I find we talk about cumulative wealth. Yes, it can seem unfair that some people come, you know, have a lot more to start with. They have advantages. That's how they climb to such heights. But the thing with the aristocracy is that I personally think is more of an important factor is that a lot of that wealth was accumulated when literally the rules were different. It's like we took it back when we were allowed to just murder and take it, and now all of a sudden, you can't, you know, that ain't the game anymore.
Exactly.
And then we won't give it back.
I feel like if Daniel Polansky wanted to give what felt like a more grounded in the world criticism of the nobility, it wouldn't be just by showing them going to a bunch of parties and, like, drinking a bunch and being degenerate. If you really wanted to make fun of them, you would show them having silly traditions. You would show them, like, going through this, it comes close to at one point when they talk about, like, the boarding school which the main villain went to. Like, that's close. You're almost getting it there. But if you just talked about them going off on silly hunts where they would dress up in fancy clothes and doing that, and, like, having big parties where they all just made kind of fools of themselves, that would be a much more on-the-nose, close-to-the-skin criticism and mockery, as opposed to just this, like, caricature that's drawn in this story, which just doesn't feel like someone who has any actual knowledge or experience of living in a country with an upper class, you know? Well, that's... I've misspoken there, because obviously America does have an upper class. That's a different thing.
But I would never say it is... I hear your point. I think that's a bit of nuance that could have been added. But personally, I don't think it negatively knocks the plot all that much. Mostly because it's not that relevant to the plot to begin with.
Yeah. I'll say one thing more about... I'll say two things more about this section. One is that I'm annoyed that Daniel Polansky developed and used the idea of a noble who's an incredibly good duelist and basically uses that to be a serial killer, because I had that idea, but I didn't write it down for Daniel Polansky, so I'm quite annoyed about that.
Oh, such a shame. So, Geordie, I think we're getting
the
more
other
into
thing,
sort of the talks of world building.
I did have two criticisms here, Duncan, and this one is frankly unforgivable, which is that Fair Beacon's henchman, what's his name? It's
also it's Beaconfield.
What did I say?
Fair Beacon.
Right. Thank you, Duncan, for backing me up, because the other guy, his name starts with Fair, and it's Fair B something, and that's super confusing. It's so frustrating and confusing, because I'm like, come on, just tell me what his name is. Because they are impossible to keep straight. Every time it mentioned one of them, I'd be like, wait, which one are you talking about? These names are identical. I've never complained about Sauron.
No, they're not. One starts with a B, one starts with an F.
That's his name.
It's not that hard.
Fair Beacon and Brightfellow. To me, these names are identical.
Okay, they both start with a B. I'll give you that.
Well, they don't. They're alternating Fs and Bs, so it's not as close as I made it out to be. But still,
no,
I could never. Literally, at one point, one of those characters dies, and I thought the wizard was dead. I'm like, okay, now get the nobleman. But the nobleman was dead. I just hadn't realized. Do you have anything nice to say now?
So I think this is a good point to bring up to the wider world building, because I actually think this is quite a nicely put together world.
I'd say so.
Now, obviously, one of the main elements in Lowtown is the idea of the classes and the class divide. Obviously, we've just addressed the fact that there is this upper class that's represented as this debaucherous rich folk who go to parties and have no cares for the problems of the little people. Fine. We also get the fact, you know, but we also get, when we get into Lowtown, the fact that Lowtown's become quite a melting pot of different cultures. And I thought that was quite an interesting look at the fact that the way we're seeing this city is that I found it so kind of multifaceted without being like going into like full-on fantasy. In sense, what am I trying to say there? There aren't like fancy people. These are all people. And it's something that I can sort of see. It gives me very much that sort of 18th century London vibes, which I imagine is what Polansky was going for.
Well, I would say he's going for more of an 18th century New York vibe, but I hear what you're saying.
And I thought this was actually really nicely well. I felt like I understood who these groups were, where they were standing, what their opinions on other groups were. It is a bit of a shame that I feel like this didn't play into the narrative as much, but I felt the fact that how it got built through these interactions. For example, Warden doesn't just tell us about these parties of the rich nobleman. He gets to go to one. Whenever we're meeting new sort of groups in Lowtown, it's not like he just goes down to the bar and Adolphus says, oh, have you heard? They've come in on a boat this morning.
Mm-hmm,
like,
sure.
Warden goes down there, you get to see how they live, and then he'll have sort of framed often in the investigation, he'll have a little vignette where he'll talk to them and they'll tell Warden a bit about, you know, what's going on for them. And I like that. I think it adds a lot of flavour to the...
Yeah, yeah. Like, there's a bit where they say that, you're like an islander, like, their most popular trade is working in the Royal Navy. And you're like, and then you have someone say like, oh, well, my son's missing and he will be for the next 9 months. And he'll be back and he'll be gone for another 9 months. And that's a nice bit of in-text world building.
And I think by kind of giving that kind of layeredness to it, it then makes me care more about this world, particularly because the big threat to this, the sort of existential threat, other than, you know, beside the murders, is the plague. So I think to have that actually have an impact or a sense of impact in the story, you need to have a sense of this community. I think that was what really
sold me. Yeah, totally, I agree.
And when the story ends, and Warden stood there, and he's going, oh, the walls are going to drop, the plague is going to return, I felt it. I was like, oh my god, all these people that we've been interacting with, like, this is going to be devastating. I'm actually really interested to see how this develops in the next tale.
I definitely agree. I think that what something that works about this in a way that didn't work in The Gutter's Prayer is that I really do feel for the city. And I really do feel like it's a living, breathing place that has a character of its own. I will say, I think that is somewhat helped by the fact that rather than creating like fictional nations, it's just like China and Pacific Islanders and nebulous Africa, you know?
Yes, that is definitely a part. And I think also that kind of talks about some of the issues we talked about at the very start of this podcast, that first saw of Black Mark, is to kind of get this through all these different people, air quotes, efficiently. We do butt up against archetypes, and the vast majority, I think, stand on the right side of the line. But like I said, there's that particular one where we're talking about sort of standing for like a Chinese culture where you're just like, oh, no, that went too far.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not even like, say, something like a book, which, you know, obviously I don't like this for a bunch of reasons, but the Poppy War, you know, in that we get to go to fantasy China, and it gets to play with creating a fantastical sense of China using a bunch of different ideas. So you have, like, in that world, their version of China is divided up into 12 districts, which are based on the different zodiac. Okay, so we've taken an aspect of Chinese culture, and we've made it a part of the setting. In this one, it's much more surface level. You know, the dress is similar. You know, you can tell that he's taking inspiration from depictions of opium dens and something like, say, The Nick, or to go back to it again, Deadwood, where it's like, okay, we're going to have like a Chinese ghetto. It's involved in crime, and they're going to have these familiar elements in it. And some of those elements are based on actual, like, disgusting racism from 19th century and early 20th century America, and really shouldn't be repeated in 2011.
It is a lack of deftness in the author side, but I think, I don't want to really defend it. That's how it only comes across. It's like, oof, how could you? But we do move on, and I don't think it's like a statement piece.
I accidentally ran into a quote I hate. This is a flashback to a coming war. And this genuinely is the one moment where I'm like, Daniel Polansky, what are your politics exactly? As for me, well, spending your childhood fighting the rats for fresh trash doesn't do much to inculcate, there's one of those $10 words, inculcate the middle class virtues of nationalism and xenophobia that make you leap at the thought of killing people you've never seen. Yes, of course, the famed middle-class value of nationalism. That definitely never has an impact on lower-class people.
Do you know what, Jordy? Sometimes when you riff into a book like this, I then end up going, oh, gosh, do I need to feel bad for liking this?
I don't. Listen, that line is so insane, out of pocket. And I'm not running defense for the middle class here. You know, Trump is just, at the time of recording this, we're like 7 days into the second Trump term. It's not just one group of people who's voting for him, you know? However, like, this is just a crazy line. Like, what planet are you living on where you're like, you can just foist the idea? You're writing a book where everyone in it except for the ultra wealthy is a poor person and all of them are bigots. Why would you write this line?
I'm also going to say, I don't think it lines up with the second book really looks into this concept of like the war veterans and war veterans associations. And I don't think it really lines up to the politics as portrayed there.
Oh boy, okay.
Right, we've gone a video off track. There was a point I wanted to make. Geordie, okay, so at the end of this book, you have that situation where the wards drop. Yes, I'm going all the way back to that moment. And yeah, it seems really interesting. Can I tell you something that I really want to get off my chest, which does bother me? And I think I need to tell you now.
All right.
The plague isn't relevant to the next two books.
No!
Yep.
What? Duncan, that's ridiculous. No, that can't be the case. That's... because that's the only thing... that's the only thing that makes me think, yeah, I gotta see how the next book shakes out, because the characters made this pivotal decision to save one life, to potentially risk the thousands and thousands of people who die from the plague. You're kidding me that the plague isn't coming back.
Nope.
Duncan, that's... okay, so this is now a 3 out of 10. Which is not fair. Obviously, I'm joking there, because you should judge a book, if you haven't read the next book, to not know that it goes downhill. I can't then judge it worse. But that's ridiculous! That's insane!
It is an incredible thing. I picked up the next book very quickly. It's called Tomorrow the Killing. And I got into it and I was like, oh, the plague isn't the focus off the bat. It's this other mystery to do with like war veteran associations. Okay, fair. Maybe it's a slow burn. Maybe this is like a bit of a wheel spin of the plague's building in the background and it's going to explode onto the scene in the third book. Also, not the case at all. It is never a threat to the city.
That's genuinely baffling. I'm just flummoxed. I can't believe you've told me this.
Because I think it's worth noting, and so I want to tell people, because I said, I like this book. I think it does a lot right. It has a lot of fun with what it's doing. But this is one thing with the whole series, where this whole book, what matters in this first book, doesn't seem to matter with the trilogy. And I do think this is worth highlighting, people. This trilogy of Lowtown really feels to me like very three distinct stories. Other than Warden's relationship with Wren, that definitely developed over a whole arc. It's very three kind of distinct mystery events. And I'm not gonna lie, reading this first book again, I was once again going, wait, did I just miss it in the second book? Did I just miss the plague subplot? And I really couldn't believe when I reread this book how much it definitively sets that up as like, this is what we're all about, and then doesn't deliver on it. And you're right, we shouldn't criticise a book for the sins of the sequel, otherwise Children of Blood and Bone, I tell you now, would be getting slated.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would definitely factor into my recommendation, because I was going to end this episode by saying the one thing that makes me want to read next is it would be interesting to see how the impact of a plague would impact the story. But if that's not going to happen, I've really lost a lot of faith in what this next book even should be about. I'm not necessarily opposed to it just being three completely separate mysteries, though. That's what's great about detective stories. That's what's great about Sherlock Holmes and Columbo, is that you tune into any adventure and you don't need to have read the previous one because it's about this mystery. I would hope that the next story would actually just be about a mystery, though. There's like, you've set the playing cards up in this one. Just have your fun in the next book. Just have it be a really solid mystery.
And that's where I need to actually come out. I've read this whole trilogy and I do think this first book, for people picking this up, is the best one of the trilogy. So to someone like you, Geordie, I think I have to be very honest. I'm like, fuck, if you did not enjoy this book, you don't need to go further. This is representative. I like the second book, by the way. It goes a lot into the background. We get a lot more war flashbacks with Warden and Adolphus, and really expands on their friendship, to the point of which, actually, when I was reading this book, there's so many facets of their friendship which I was surprised aren't in this book, and I've seen they must all be introduced in the sequel.
I did like Adolphus and Adeline, so yeah, that's good. I won't be reading their book. I'm not interested in hearing more about his experiences at war. I would probably just prefer to read a book that's about that instead of a book where they're constantly looking back at the past. So yeah, was he? Just to be honest, if it's about like corrupt veterans associations, just fucking read Jack Ryan. All right, Duncan, I've got time for one more complaint.
Lay it upon me, and then I'll mount my final defense.
Before I do that, to be nice, I will read a quote which I found funny and I laughed at. You have any proof? None whatsoever. But if you get his name and residence, you'll find a memento he kept. Maybe a piece of clothing. You'll probably even find a few of them. You don't even know his name? I don't have time for these trivialities, Crispin. I work in the private sector now. That was a good line. I laughed at that.
It's fun. I think there were quite a few fun moments and interactions throughout this book.
Yeah, I saw your highlights on Kindle. One final complaint. The fight scenes were shit.
I would also have to agree. These are not particularly interesting things of combat. There's not a lot of... What I really like in a combat scene is a lot of thinking, a lot of reaction, a lot of I'll do this, you do that, or... You know, treating it more like a puzzle and an interesting application of the environment and our characters' abilities.
Yeah.
A lot of the fight scenes in this, I find, tend to go down to one guy either gets the jump or wails on one bloke, and then one thing will happen, and that other bloke, mm-hmm. normally Warden, stands back up and then wails on the other bloke.
Yeah, for sure. At the first time it shows up, The first fight scene is just the, hey, did you know my cool badass hero can beat people up? And I'm like, uh-huh, cool. I haven't seen that before. Just beats up some drug dealers who were on his turf because, you know, it's, oof, whatever. Just cringe. But then the next, and just frankly, the most offensive one of all is this scene where he's like being chased across various rooftops by like dudes with swords. And this scene actually starts okay. I like the first exchanges. I like the scene where he like has to jump through a window, and after the dudes follow him, he's able to sort of pounce on them. That all works pretty well until a dude has to like fight him one-on-one, and like there's no trickery here, you just gotta fight it out. And at this point it's just so embarrassing, you know. The first thing that he does is when he draws his sword, he says, I drew my sword, and I held it backhanded, and I just was like, ugh, don't do that, that's stupid. That's a thing, you know, you see in, like, video games and schlocky fantasy movies where people hold swords the wrong way round, and you're like, that doesn't work, it's stupid, it's cringy. And then there's a bit where he wins in this fight because he slips his hand into his pocket and pulls out knuckle dusters, and then in an exchange he punches the other guy, and I think to myself, like, why didn't you just punch him normally? What, you didn't need knuckle dusters to do that. If you punched him in the face then, he probably would have fallen over just like he did then, except you wouldn't have broken your hand because knuckle dusters are really bad for you.
The knuckle dusters I let slide personally, but the backhand sword, every time I see that, I have to like hold my own arm out and go, wouldn't it be better if I could point it towards them? I just don't.
Yeah, exactly. And it's even a bit, it's just like, so that the flat of the blade was against my arm. And I'm like, that's great, man. Except now your knuckles are literally pointing at your enemy and he's just going to chop your hand off.
It's like if you wanted to be nice to a person and not use the sword. It also means that any...
So silly.
Like, there's blade also work, a bit... though, has to happen close to your body instead of far away.
And the dude had a longer sword as well. He was using a saber. And there's a bit even where he says, like, and he chopped me with a two-handed swing. I'm like, a saber's two-handed? I don't think they are. Why is he putting the second hand?
He's grappling it round his original hand.
The most offensive part is the last fight. You know, he has to fight potentially the best swordsman in the world. And his genius strategy for this is he puts a bomb on the other side of the wall and he explodes both of them.
It is a high risk, high reward strategy.
It's incredible. He set off two bombs. He's like, in case the first one doesn't do a trick, I put a second bomb underneath. Motherfucker, if you thought you could end this with a bomb, why did you put yourself in the same room as him? Just blow up the room and then walk in!
Sorry. Yes, that hadn't occurred to me. What? Or the very least, yeah. I get the impression it's the wall that's like to the side of both of them. Not even the wall behind him.
No, exactly. The literal thing is he says, like, obviously I was knocked over too, but I'd been expecting it.
Oh, but that's how it works. Drop and roll.
It's so good. I also, one more one more trivial thing, which is just such a nitpick. Oh, two more nitpicks. One nitpick is that in that same fight scene, when he goes for him, he says, "I tried to rabbit punch him in the throat." Duncan, do you know what a rabbit punch means?
Not a clue.
A rabbit punch is a punch to the back of the neck. You cannot rabbit punch someone in the throat. That's just a punch.
Okay. One more.
There's a bit in the story at one point.
One more.
There's a bit in the story at one point where he describes a character as having red shot pupils.
Red shot pupils?
Yes.
Does he need to see a doctor? I think it's blind.
Yeah, you can't have red shot pupils. A pupil is like the black bit in the middle of your eye. You have red shot sclera. The stuff, the white bits around the iris and pupil.
You also just say red shot eyes. Like, we know what you mean.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And this is where you come down to him having to have just one step above in this extra special flowery language. Because any ordinary person would saying...
This genuinely... So, are we saying this is one step above the eye of Argon? And tears leaked from his eyeballs. And he used the, what was it? Like, the pelvis bone of a rat to punch a guy with. And we had the same argument. Surely, because you're punching them, doubt yes. The bone makes any difference.
It's true. Oh, you're right. It is one step above the eye of Argon.
Okay, I need to respond to a lot of Georgie's comments. So earlier on, I made a comment about how maybe the character of Warden has a certain attitude, a sort of sliminess, a sort of what he thinks is cool. And I said it quite demurringly, talking about, you know, that would be appeal to like a 14-year-old teenager. That's what they think is cool. Geordi, really, to be honest, the only real last defense I have of this is to just admit something. And that's that the 14-year-old within me just really enjoyed all of that crap.
I understand. I do.
Deeply.
I do. You know, there's a place in the world for trashy entertainment.
And I know we're laughing, and like, the fight scenes, you're right, it's so stupid. And when he did the sword backhand, I was there like, oh, that's so stupid. And then a bit of me's like, yeah, but the visual's kind of fun, isn't it?
I'll tie it back into something that works. You know who else does annoying, stupid backhand sword stuff? The Witcher. The Witcher TV show. Geralt does that all the time. Did I get annoyed when they did it there? Yes. Did it look kind of cool? Yes. Yes, it did look kind of cool.
I would say there's another book which obviously speaks to a very similar vibe of a noir fantasy. And obviously something that we haven't mentioned throughout this entire episode. And that's the Dresden Files.
Well, there's a reason for that, Duncan. I haven't read one of them.
I have read one of them. To be fair, only one. But I know that book has a massive fan base. And if you read the early ones, the main character is despicable. In the sense that he is a pretty big misogynist. And like, that's a massive detracting point. But I have heard he gets better throughout the books. And, you know, it has the same level of cringe or trying to be cool. And a similar argument, I would say, where it's like, you know, the author's trying to write a character that's misogynistic. And, you know, through a lack of finesse, comes off a bit worse overall. And I think it's the same way of how Daniel Polanski is dealing with some of his social issues in this book series. And I'm not saying it's good or that you need to hold it up as fine literature, but I know there is other people out there that probably like similar schlock as I do.
Mm.
And it just speaks to just enough fun. I like the fact that Warden's a cocky shithead, because you're right, there's a bit of me that does go along on that power of fantasy and go, yeah, cool, let's outsmart all of them. But then I do like the fact that he has those sort of self-destructive tender moments when he goes back to Adolphus as well. I think that builds really nicely. Rereading this book, Geordi, I liked the bits I always liked. I re-felt the disappointment over the ending and knowing it does not go anywhere. But ultimately, the execution and the world building, this is something that goes all the way back to, I think we spoke about Malice ages ago, and I said how I never felt the crackling of the fire, or there was never a scene where they all sit down and eat dinner that I really, you know, could taste the food. in Lowtown, I really feel like I could sense the environment. I have such a strong idea in this book, like when they're in the tavern, when he's drinking his bitter beer, when he has like hard, you know, eggs in the morning and the yolk isn't very runny.
Mm.
And he goes out on the street and the scents and the smells and the feel of this city. I really got that out of this book and I really drank that in.
I hear you, man. I do. I really do. And I think I felt some of that too. It's just that I, you know, Duncan, I haven't done this for a while, but for a good period of time, when work was done and I was really tired and I couldn't be bothered to go to the gym, I would sit down on the sofa and I would watch House. And what works about House is that it does have this smart but cruel, very sardonic main character. He's another, like, cynical take on Sherlock Holmes. And you watch him sort of be a tool and be pretty insufferable to his co-workers throughout the whole of the first season. That's what this book reminded me of. Because you have this guy being smarter than everyone else around him, and none of them can, like, talk smack back to him because he's just too clever. What it doesn't remind me of is, like, season 2 and 3 of House. Because in season 2 and 3 of House, the other characters have sort of wised up to him, and they are shit-talking him back. And it's so much more entertaining when you get to have the genius character actually have competition, that he has to prove that he's so smart and that his quips are just on point. You actually have to have him fight to win and not just be automatically correct. This book wasn't there. It wasn't at the point where I felt like the character's cleverness was earned. It never felt like he had actual competition. The only times he got to be wrong was when he was dramatically wrong, when the story is set up for him to just not get it right. Take, for example, the bit where he goes to ask someone for help, and he thinks so little of this guy's capability that he just rules out the possibility that this dude could ever get him the information he's after. And that comes back to bite him in the ass, because that dude actually does provide him information that he needs, and he ignores it because he thinks that he doesn't require his help. That was good. That was one of the better scenes in the book. Strong dramatic irony. This book could have been more like that, and if it had, I wouldn't be rating this as a 5 out of 10.
Well, I think that's honestly a nice point to end on. I don't think I have anything else to add. And I like that you do highlight that those moments that do hint at that kind of greater depth, this book isn't completely bereft of them. There just aren't many. Ah, that's the end of the sentence. There just aren't many. Well, Geordie, I think I have, like I said, no more to add. When it comes to recommendations, I think it's pretty clear from my standpoint that the type of person who would like this book is someone who already likes books like this. If you're someone who has read, like, The Dresden Files, this is a golden recommendation. And generally, if you're someone that feels like they can buy into a bit more of the cringe and the stereotypicalness of the sort of noir detective story and likes the sound of having that put in this sort of 18th century New York / London world, go for it. I certainly think you'll get enough good out of this that you will enjoy it. If you're already sort of prepped and interested on a concept level, on like a premise level.
Except you should just read this first book and not the sequels.
Except you should probably just read this first book and not the sequels. No, I would say, listen, read this. I recommend to everyone who is in that category, read this first book. Be aware the sequels do not go with this first book of his to set up. And in general, I would ask you maybe to sit down again and ask yourself how much you really enjoyed this first book before pushing onto the sequels. I think if you're at that 5 out of 10 stage, you probably might want to take a step back, because I do think the sequels kind of drop a point. We don't normally do points. We've talked about them a lot this episode. The sequels do drop like a level for me.
There are only 3 ratings for me. 1 out of 10, 5 out of 10, and 9.5 out of 10. Those are the only times I give scores.
That's why we do recommendations. I think that means so much more than a score can ever sum up. So, Geordie, what's your recommendation, if you do?
Don't read this book. It'll waste your time.
I feel heartily disagree. So, Geordie, talking about a book maybe that won't waste our time, this was my pick. I'm glad you read it. What are you going to answer with? Where are you taking us next?
Duncan, we start off this year with a dark, brooding take on fairy tales. We followed it up with a dark, brooding take on urban fantasy by turning it into a noir detective story. Maybe it's time, as the days are getting brighter, that we start up with a more light-hearted, chipper, bright story. What do you think?
Oh, definitely time for that. Do I hear the flutter? Is Tay Pratchett on the cards? Are we going full kind of comedy?
No! It's February! I hate February! It's my least favourite month. We're reading The Black Company by Glenn Cook.
Sorry. I wasn't expecting that setup. Yes, The Black Company. Another series that I have read through. And oh my goodness, Geordie. There is Grimdark. And there's The Black Company. The all-father of the genre. Wow, I cannot wait.
I'm excited. I'm really excited to see where this goes. Because everyone says, you know, as they say, grandfather of Grimdark. You know, Warhammer 40k wouldn't exist about this. I'm excited. I think this is going to be a dark but fun time. That's what I'm expecting.
And I can promise you, you're going to get half of that without a doubt. So, thank you everyone for listening. If you have read The Shakespeare Razor Cure or have opinions on it and you want to share, if you're on my side or Geordie's or have a third way is yours, let us know. The best place, as always, is our Instagram, This Fantasy Podcast on Instagram. Another great place to contact us is our Gmail, thisfantasypodcast@gmail.com. Love to hear from everyone. It really makes my day. Even when people just message me like, hi, I just enjoyed that most recent episode. I share it with Geordie. It makes both of our days. It just puts a smile on our faces. So please do
reach out.
Instagram is also a great place to see other additional tips and information and the latest episodes when they are released. So do that there. Also, please, so I need to take a breath. There's a lot on this sort of standard. You've got to get through it all. Also, please, leave a rating review on your podcast listening profile of choice. That's the easiest option. You just have to hit 5 stars on Spotify, and it makes us also very happy, and may mean more people get to then listen to us. So you're just sharing the joy with other people. It's charity. Is it charity? Yeah, it's basically charity. So how about that?
Yeah,
it'd be amazing.
I look forward to seeing you again, Duncan, in February to talk about The Black Company.
As always, I've been your host, Duncan Nicol.
And I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
Till next time.
Bye-bye.